Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Spotlight for Justice. I'm Michelle Bart, the president and founder of the National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation, other known as NWCAVE. And joining me in a few minutes is Dr. Kathy Mathis, CEO of California Cognitive Behavioral Institute. Dr. Mathis also serves on our board of directors as our National Training and Education Director. Today marks the 40th annual National Missing Children's Day. In 1979, President Ronald Reagan named the day in memory of six-year-old Aiden Patz, who vanished walking alone to school for the first time to the bus in New York City. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children was then later created in 1984. And as the CEO, Michelle, of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children said, as we commemorate National Missing Children's Day, we hold close in our hearts the families and loved ones who must go to sleep every night not knowing where their children are. I can't agree more. Dr. Mathis, are you on the call?
I am on the call. Thank you very much.
Welcome back. Welcome back. And Spotlight for Justice is a show put on and sponsored by NWCAVE. We're an anti-violence organization headquartered in Vancouver, Washington, and with offices in Oregon, California, and Arizona. And since our inception, we've had a very active missing children's division. We have worked on over 100 cases, not only locally, but nationally as well. And on April 25th, 2009, a young lady by the name of Brittany Drexel, 17 years old, decided to go away, unbeknownst to her family, to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. You're going to hear from her mother, Dawn, in a few minutes, as well as Dawn's attorney, and also an executive director of the Broken Link Foundation. Originally, we were to have the mother of Kara Nichols also on the show today. But if you've been following our cases, Kara Nichols went missing on Tuesday, October 9th, 2012. That has been our case since 2012. Pretty much the entire time NWCAVE has been in existence. That has been our longest case. Kara's remains were found in February of 2022. Somebody has been arrested, and we go to trial on June 12th of this year. So for that purpose, we are not going to be speaking with Julia and Paul Nichols this afternoon due to the fact that we do not want to jeopardize anything in regards to a mistrial and jury selection, etc. But as soon as the trial is over and we get a little bit of justice for Kara and her family, you can rest assured that her parents will be back on the show. But for now, I'd like to bring on Dawn, Brittany's mother. Brittany's remains were found 13 years after she had been missing. And Dawn and I go back a long way as well. And we want to continue to have a voice for justice and shine a spotlight to get justice for families that have to go through the agony of never knowing where their child is, and then decades later be able to at least have a little bit of closure. And I say that very loosely. Dawn, are you with us?
I am. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, stranger. Haven't seen you in a while. Lots happened since you and I and many other families went to New York to put the word out to find your beautiful daughter. Before we bring on your attorney, Jared, let's talk a little bit about catching folks up about Brittany. And Dr. Mathis is on the call with us as well. So if you happen to have any questions for her, feel free and put those out there. But if you're listening to the show today, all of our guests will take your calls. The call-in number is area code 515-602-9601. So, Dawn, how did we get here?
I'm sorry, Michelle, can you say that again?
I said, you know, Brittany went missing in 2009. We're now in 2023. How did we get here, honey?
Well, I can tell you that when Brittany's case first started back in 2009, law enforcement had been working on her case. There was three jurisdictions at that time, which were Myrtle Beach, Georgetown County, and Charleston County. And also a SLED, which is the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division. Up until 2016, everybody heard everybody had heard the press conference ad in reference to Brittany's case. After that, I had met four new FBI agents. I fought very tirelessly to get the FBI involved in Brittany's case, probably from the time that she went missing in 2009 up until probably about maybe 2013, 2014. But after that press conference, I got four new FBI agents that were on Brittany's case. And what they did was they ruled out what the FBI had come out with in that press conference in 2016. They did that. They called me and they asked if they could go back all the way to the beginning of her case. So what they ended up doing is they started from the beginning. There was no new information that the FBI had. They were given everything that the other four law enforcement agencies had given them. We talked extensively on the phone. The FBI agents actually gave me their personal cell phone numbers, and I was on the phone with them probably every 3 weeks just to check in and see what was going on. I also had a couple meetings with them along with Jarrett. And, I've always done a lot of media on Brittany because I wanted to keep her name and face out there. It's very important. So in 2018, we had went, January of 2018 or 2019. And I had a meeting in Myrtle Beach with the FBI. I know Myrtle Beach was in there. I think someone was from Georgetown County was there, but there was a lot of law enforcement agencies that were in this meeting. And I was so fed up with and frustrated with what was going on in Brittany's case I went into this meeting very upset. I said, I'm sick of, I just told him, I'm done with the lies, the smoke and mirrors. I said, I want my daughter found. And from that point on, I mean, they worked Brittany's case, like, tirelessly. And then I would say in 2021, we had been talking all along with the FBI. And all of us, I'm sorry, it's just having to remember, to go back and remember everything. But the FBI had called me, and they had kept updating me and telling me, you know, we're looking at, you know, multiple people. And I believe probably by the end of 2021, we were down to like two people. It was person A and person B. And after that, they had kept on, you know, working her case and you know, analyzing, you know, going down every road they could go down. And I met with them in April. It was close to Brittany's anniversary date. And they had brought me in, and they had told me that they were going to start interviewing person A and person B. So once they did that, it went fairly quickly. They called me.
Dawn, are you there?
Can you hear me?
You're breaking up a little, hon.
Oh, sorry. In May, they had the FBI had called me, and they had told me that they were going to do a search for Brittany, and they had come up. After speaking with person B.
Dawn, are you there? Jared, are you with us?
I am.
Okay. We lost Dawn. She'll be back. I know you've been working with Dawn for the last few years on her case. Please introduce yourself to our listeners and tell us how you got involved.
Sure. First of all, it's a pleasure to be with you, Michelle and Dr. Mathis. I became involved. I'm a prosecutor in northeastern Pennsylvania, about 600 miles north of where Brittany went missing. I became involved because Dawn, who's made so many friends and her extended family along her pursuit and search for Brittany, In the relationships she built, she befriended a mutual friend of ours, and that she was describing the frustration she started to feel when the wrong suspects were named in Brittany's case and the credibility of certain members of law enforcement started to wane. She reached out to our mutual friend, Steph Watts, who's a journalist, an investigative journalist, and said, I need help. You know, I don't trust some of the members of law enforcement at this point. I need an advocate that can attend these meetings with me. And Steph had covered a trial of a serial killer I did up in Pennsylvania. And he said, look, I want to introduce you to our friend. Initially,
Steph is a great
guy. Well, he is. He's fantastic.
He is a wonderful guy.
He introduced us. Initially, I said, you know, Steph, I don't know what I can do for Dawn. I was familiar with Brittany's case. I said, but I'm far away. I'm not licensed in South Carolina. And he said, just listen to her and promise me you'll listen to her. And I've been listening to Dawn for about 3 years now. If she's there, she could tell you that. But
she's
the first
back
conversation,
on the line with us.
in the first conversation, it became clear that this was not someone that was going to accept no for an answer. And I joined her team in the pursuit of Brittany's justice, and we've been part of Don's extended family ever since.
Don, do we have you back?
Yes, you do. I'm sorry. Where I live is just the cell service is terrible here. So
No worries.
Hopefully I won't lose you again.
We're getting familiar with your lawyer, Jared, is on the call. And, of course, he just spoke highly of Steph Watts, which we just adore.
Yes.
And, and so I'll let you pick up where you left off, Dawn, and know that you've got all of us here, including Dr. Kathy Mathis. And if anyone wants to call in with any questions of our guests, the call-in number is 515-602-9601. Go ahead, Dawn.
All right. Yeah, Jarrett and Steph are, let me tell you, they are a godsend. I thank God for them every day. You know, getting me through a lot of what I went through. But as I was saying, in May of 2022, the FBI had told me that they were going to do a search for Brittany. They had a location that they wanted to search. And this was an area that had never been searched prior. And they went to this area, and they had multiple, I think, law enforcement agencies assisting them. They took Raymond Moody out to this location, and he pointed out where he buried Brittany. And so I think it was on a Wednesday, because it had taken them a couple days to go ahead and you know, get the location, the exact location where she was, because they had been digging, you know, in an area. And just to let you know, this was on someone's private property. People had bought it, I believe in like 2018 or 19. They had to find the exact location. So they were digging and digging. And on Thursday, they had called me, and they had said that they had found human remains. And they would work through the night to exhume her body from the ground, and it would be sent over to the coroner. And also the – are you there?
We're here.
Okay.
Can you hear us?
And then the medical examiner had come out and brought Brittany's remains to MUSC, which is in Charleston. So from there, they identified Brittany with her dental records, and they, you know, forensically, they did what they had to do. When they found her, they found her nose ring and also one of her contact lenses. And they had called and proceeded to tell me that they were going to work through the night, you know, and to get her identified. So it was very quick getting her identified. I think it only took maybe, I think, Jarrett, if I'm not mistaken, I think we found out Thursday, and they called us back on Friday, I believe.
Yes, that's correct.
That's when we ended up traveling down to South Carolina.
That seems pretty quick, Jared. As a prosecutor, do you normally see cases that go that quickly?
Well, there was a high expectation, Michelle, that Brittany's remains were going to be located there. So the lab and the personnel were set up to do the necessary identifying that had to be done. So all of that was in place. So that's how she was positively identified so quickly.
Gotcha. Go ahead, Dawn.
Mm-hmm. And then also, after we got to South Carolina, we had a meeting with the FBI, and they told us that Brittany was abducted from Ocean Boulevard and was taken to Georgetown County. And if people have followed her story, the boat landing where they had first searched for her was where he had set up a tent. And he set up this tent, you know, prior to them being down in Myrtle Beach. And from what we know, Raymond Moody and Angel Voss were in the vehicle when Brittany was abducted. They drove all the way down to Georgetown. He had a tent set up. And he said that Brittany wanted to smoke pot with them. Brittany never smoked a cigarette. She hated the smell. So I knew right then and there that, you know, he was lying about that. But he took her there. He raped her, and he strangled her to death. After he did that, he wrapped her up, and I believe it was he wrapped her up in a blanket, and he set her in part of the woods just for a little while, I believe, and then he came back to pick her up and bring her to where he buried her. Now, Raymond Moody is a level 3 sex offender, and he served 40 years, supposed to serve 40 years in prison in California for brutally raping girls from the ages of 8, I believe, until to 17. And he served 20 years, and then he was let out.
Why was he let out?
That's what we're trying to find out. We know he was let out in the city of South Carolina. And after that, I have no idea what happened. What monitoring was done. I have seen that, you know, he did have charges on him as far as not registering as a sex offender. And he had two offenses for not registering, and then one for indecent exposure. Been put back in prison at that point was not.
Well,
Dr.
one
Mathis,
of the things, and then
Dr. ended up
Mathis,
killing my daughter.
I'm sorry for interrupting, but this is Dr. Mathis, and I just wanted to say, a lot of times, and I know you mentioned he was in California, and I live in California and work in California, and one of the issues and the problems in this state is that over the years, and it's probably not just California, it could be other states, but I can only talk about mine that I live in, and that is that we have had a shift over the years in the mentality of the Department of Corrections and keeping, you know, inmates in there.
Dr.
Mathis,
I can't hear you.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear
I
me
can.
Now? Okay. I'll keep talking. Maybe she can, you know, click in from her
Michelle,
area.
Are you still
but
there?
One of the things that happens
Hello?
Is that there's a shift in mentality as to what we as a society should be doing with the prisoners that are in prison. And there's, as you know, in the media, celebrities that are getting on board that it's, you know, punishment and we need to let them out sooner and we shouldn't punish them as harshly. And, you know, all of that is going on. And so what they are doing in California is they're letting them out of prison sooner. They're closing down prisons. They're dumping and overloading these inmates on probation, which is already, you know, to the max as well. And there's a conception that some of these inmates can be saved, that they're not really as bad as people say they are. And, you know, we've been raised to think there's good in everybody. Well, that's a myth. There is not good in everybody. And you cannot save some of these individuals that are in prison because they are so warped, so broken, and so without a soul and connection to empathy that if you let them out, they're going to go back and repeat. Department of Corrections is not a rehabilitation place. They try. They put, you know, things in place for rehabilitation. But if you're going to prison, you're going there because you have done something that society says is worthy of that punishment. And then once you get there, you should stay there for the full length of time that you were put there and not let out early and not be looked at as somebody who can be rehabilitated and put back on the streets when you are a sex offender, when you are a murderer, and when you have no ability to reconnect your psychological, emotional, and spiritual self to a soul. And research shows that these people are called soulless because they have disconnected themselves in order to perpetrate the crimes that they perpetrate. So it isn't surprising that he was let out. You know, that happens
without
a lot
conditions,
and now more than ever.
Dr. Mathis, without conditions or an ankle monitor or any of that?
Yeah. And then even when they have it, you have to remember they're overwhelmed with these individuals on their case. So it's like Department of Children and Family Services, which is one of the worst government agencies we have. They have so many people on their caseload that people slip through. They don't follow up because they are overwhelmed with what, you know, is being given them to manage. And so even if they have a monitor, that doesn't mean that they are keeping track of them. When they get out, they're supposed to register, but a lot of them don't. And that is not, you know, that is not discovered until, unfortunately, after they've committed another act. So, I mean, there's a lot of different things that go on with all of that and Department of Corrections, et cetera, and these individuals that are repeat murderers and offenders, et cetera, in our society. And having worked and having one of the biggest practices with offenders for years, I realized when I was much younger and working with them how broken they are and how my upbringing. And I consider myself, you know, especially back then, now I'm a little jaded because I've been doing this for such a long time. But back then, I was like everybody else going, well, we should give everybody a second chance. Well, that's a myth. No, we shouldn't. No, we shouldn't. And so when Donna's talking about, you know, what set up to her daughter being, you know, murdered by this individual who never should have been let out in the first place, we need to look at our systems, but we also need to look at society and how we look at our systems and not go along with people, everybody can be saved because they can't. And Don, I wanted to ask you a question because I know, you know, people who are listening to this, they're hearing you talk about your daughter's murder very calmly. You know, you've been going through all of your emotions for a long, long time. And as you tell this story, which is horrible, I mean, you've experienced one of the worst nightmares a parent could ever experience, and it never goes away. It's with you for your entire life. So you're a victim as well, and all of the people who loved your daughter are victims as well. But I wanted people to understand that when you tell your story, if you don't tell it the way you're telling it, with your matter of fact, this is what happened, this is what I did, whatever, if you allow yourself to reopen to what that's really like, the raw truth and emotion of being a mother of a child that's been murdered, you couldn't tell your story. Is that correct?
That's correct.
That's correct. I mean, I can tell you that I've been through hell. You know, this past 13 years have been a total hell for me. And I am very upset. I want laws passed, and that's something that I'm going to be working on, because level 3 sex offenders, they're not rehabilitative. You cannot right. rehabilitate them. They let him out probably with only one of the psychiatrists, you know, that was working with him in that prison. I mean, I don't understand how all of this slipped through the cracks, because my daughter paid the ultimate price for this.
And do we know, Dawn, do we know that he didn't reoffend with anybody else from California all the way through the United States before he found Brittany?
I'm not sure. I know there was, I heard that there was a couple girls that were almost taken in Myrtle Beach prior to Brittany going missing. So I'm not sure if he was part of that. But with his MO that we know of, I mean, he was doing this like every month.
Yeah,
Yeah, and he would stalk his victims and things like that. I mean, he's a monster. That's all I can say. I'm glad that he got what he received, but that will never is. I don't know if I can forgive that, but I can never. I don't know if I can. You probably wouldn't get it unless you know you've had a missing child. But for someone to just, for him to fall through the cracks, knowing what type of person he was so that he could re-victimize again is just absolute absurd to me. I don't know why or how he was monitored. We're looking into that, you know, because I don't want this to ever happen to anyone else's family ever again.
And this is Dr. Mathis again, and I want to interject because not only, you know, there was something else that you said a little earlier that I want to sort of look at as well, and that is not only did the Department of Corrections allow this guy out and whatever happened at that point and that, you know, they're part of victimizing you, but you also made a statement that you had to confront the FBI. And you had to let them know that you were tired of the lies, the smoke and mirrors. Those were the words that you used, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So when another family may, you know, be going through what you have gone through and are still going through, you know, when you get into this, you, at least I would, have a presumption that FBI would do their job and law enforcement would do their job mm-hmm. and their due diligence in helping, but it sounds to me like you had to sort of confront them to get them off of their rear ends to do more than what they had been. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Sure. At first when the FBI agents, these four FBI agents got into Brittany's case, I didn't trust any of them because I wasn't getting any answers or anything prior to. And it took me just once talking to the FBI agent. He's very seasoned. His name is Mike. He's a very seasoned FBI. And I told him, I said, if this was your child, this child would have been found already. And he said, Dawn, that is not fair. And I said, yes, it is. I said, Mike, I want Brittany found. So I think after that, they kind of knew I was really, really pissed off, you know, I'm not going to take anybody's crap anymore. Like I'm done, found, and I want answers and I want justice to be served. But what people don't understand is we have some justice for Brittany right now. but there's still someone else out there. And to me, it's accountability. It's a very huge word. You have to hold them accountable. You have to be on top of law enforcement. You have to.
Well, I can say from, this is Michelle, and from our perspective and from my perspective from doing this since 2008 on missing children's cases, it is just heartbreaking, watching all of you search high and low for your children. Your child is missing, and let's make something clear to our audience. It doesn't matter the color of your skin. It doesn't matter your culture. It doesn't matter your age. It doesn't matter what you were wearing. If you were drunk, or if you were on drugs, or if you have a mental illness, none of that matters when a human life goes missing at no fault of their own, and we need to put that to rest, because I'm so tired of hearing she's just a runaway. Oh, he's a kid. Kids will be kids. No. If a child goes missing, our tax dollars pay for the services that serve and protect us to find us if we go missing. And when you watch these families go through what they have to go through in order to find their child, the expense that they have to go through. I've known many family members who have lost their jobs because they took too much time off to find their missing child. It's pulling teeth with law enforcement on all avenues and all levels of law enforcement. And in so many cases, unless a local jurisdiction puts their pride in their pocket and calls the feds in right away, then it's like pulling teeth for them to say, yeah, it's finally time for the feds. And guess what? By then, it may be too late. And so watching 15 years of families go through the agony of searching, and I'm trying to watch my vocabulary these days, because
I know
it's, is there justice? I was telling your attorney, Jared, I don't know if there's justice. You know,
Michelle,
go ahead, Jared.
Justice is one of those words. It's like trying to grab water and defining it. One thing I want to say about Don's story in particular is, you know, when I'm telling Don's story, I ask parents and families, I say, did you ever lose your child when you were shopping or on the beach? And you feel that sense of panic come over you for the moments that you don't know where they are and when they're found. I said, now imagine stretching that anxiety, pain, and terror over 13 years, and then you will have some idea of what Don Drexel went through. The other thing is, and I think we've referenced it, in 2016, the FBI held a press conference naming a group of young individuals as the suspects in Brittany's case and said that they shot her and fed her to alligators, fed her remains to alligators at a press conference where Don was present. That turned out to not be true, and those individuals turned out to not be responsible in any way for Brittany's abduction or rape or killing. So that adds to the roller coaster ride that Don was on with law enforcement through the year. So you could imagine the terror of having no answers, the terror and reality of having that answer, then to only learn that that answer is wrong, and we are back at square one with this case. And that's where we found ourselves 3 years ago, 4 years ago, with this new FBI team. So this has been a special kind of hell for Dawn as a parent of a missing child. And really, her persistence, her toughness through this, her love of her daughter really is exemplary and inspired these agents. You know, I was present for those meetings with Dawn, and I've been at many of those meetings, and Michelle and Dr. Mathis, you've been involved in enough cases. You know the hopelessness and the hope that fills those rooms. And being a part of that, I truly didn't know if we'd ever find justice for Brittany. And the justice is this. The man responsible will be behind bars for the rest of his life. That is partial justice. Nothing will ever bring Brittany back. But if another young woman could be saved because Raymond Moody is behind bars and he cannot have another shallow grave, that's the hope. That is the little bit of justice that we can get and hope for.
And how do we know for certain, Jared, that he won't beat the system again and be back out on the street like he was
in
California?
In his case in particular, he has already pled guilty and has been sentenced to life without the chance of parole. So in his case, there is a very, very there's just no chance he's going to be out as a free man. There is not really an avenue for him to appeal that I could see. So we do know it's a pretty safe bet he's not going anywhere. Now, that doesn't mean that's the case for others in the system. But in Raymond Moody's case at this time, you know, I could say with some certainty that he's never going to be a free man.
So,
Dr.
Mathis, let me ask you this. Not only did Dawn go through 13 horrible years looking for her daughter, now, as her attorney mentioned, in 2016, there was miss periods, I guess, in which they were going to prosecute the wrong people for a crime they never committed and the lies that she had to go through. But then she finds out the truth. But then she finds that the system also did as much damage to her and Brittany as the perpetrator. How does one live life going through that kind of mental torment like we see in so many families?
Well, very good question. First of all, I'd like to say that when Jared said that when he's telling this story, he gives a really good example of that initial shock, horror, and terror that a parent can feel when they can't find their child. I mean, I lost my daughter in a clothing store, you know, and I remember calling her name and could not find her. And those emotions that come over you, you can't describe them. They're undescribable. And, you know, you have not only the shock, the fear, the horror that maybe somebody took your child, but then, you know, it moves into, you know, some thoughts that are, you know, disorientating and disorganizing. And you go, what do I do? What do I do? And fortunately for me, my daughter was hiding underneath, you know, a rack of blouses. And she came out and said, oh, I was just hiding so we could play hide and seek. Well, that is, again, a very good example of trying to get the initial reaction. But, you know, also Jared said exactly how somebody like Dawn and all the families like Dawn and her family have to experience. The thing that gets them through is resilience, number one. Number two, not everybody's like Dawn and stands up and says, I'm tired of your bullshit, and I'm tired of your lying, and I'm tired of this. And if this was your child, this child would already be fine. Not all of them are like her and get that, you know, power behind her, turning the anger into a motivating force to do what she should never have to do. Because these systems that are in our country should be set up to where, why, you know, to do their job and to do it without having to have a family member of a missing and murdered child have to confront them on what they're doing and not doing. And so having that resilience is number one. Also, number two, having an inner strength that they tap into, and how they find it is an independent journey with each one. But tapping down inside to find that inner strength that they have to help them through the process of what Dawn has described to us today, and knowing that all of these systems that are set up to help her actually re-traumatized her as well and made her a victim in each of those systems. And so when we look at this and we look at what these, you know, the amazing courage and strength that Dawn has, I mean, you can't commend her enough for her tenacity and everything else that she's had to go through because of what has been put in her path that no parent of any missing child knows is going to be put in their path until they're in that position. And most of society, when they look in, go, oh, but we have law enforcement. They'll help her. We have they'll help her. I don't have to do anything, because, and that's the farthest thing from the truth. They don't help unless you have somebody like Dawn who stands in her truth, finds that inner strength, and also who has compassion. And I'm talking about compassion for self, and for the other family members, that hopefully they find their compassion to where these families aren't torn apart, because a lot of these stressors that are coming in from the outside break up families. We know that there are suicides in these families. We know that there's, you know, all kinds of physical and emotional stressors and illnesses that come in these families. So I think that, you know, when we hear Dawn and we are given a perfect example of this amazing woman that she is and continues to be, that ultimate justice, and if there is such a thing, is when she can make a law or when she can stand in her truth and get others to hear it and change happens. And that for a family is where they feel justice is, because there is no justice that he goes back to prison for life. What kind of justice is that? He never should have been out anyway. So that's a given. Right. He should go there and stay there.
And Dr. Mathis, one of the things I want to say, Dawn sells herself short a little bit. It wasn't just her asking questions of the FBI and telling them, as powerful as it is, many parents and many mothers in particular ask that very question. What if this was your daughter? Dawn actually built a team around her. She has, and when we first actually met in person, Dawn regularly shows up with an entourage of volunteers that have become part of her inner circle, people who really had no connection to Brittany or to Dawn, that were inspired by her continuously getting Brittany's story out. She has a friend, Kim, who Kim is a retired police officer who spends her days poring over police reports and the Brittany case and looking at every angle of this, and other friends that we met along the way. Dawn inspired those people to join with her, and including Brittany's friends, raising awareness, having walks, organizing searches. And you got to realize, too, Dawn was not a native of South Carolina. She was from Rochester, New York, 660 miles away. Came to a strange state and a strange land with its own traditions. And quite honestly, some people there welcomed her with open arms. Some people wish she never came there, because she never stopped fighting for Brittany and never gave up and never stopped getting those answers. And the awareness she raised inspired people to help her. And that really was where the case never went away. We learned through the investigation that Raymond Moody used to see a billboard with Brittany's face on it, and it would shake him to the core. It would rattle him, and he would say to his significant other, I wish those people would just go away. I wish they would just stop, knowing full well the gig was going to be up someday.
So I have a question for both the attorney and Dr. Mathis on this, because this is where I'm having some major issues with so many cases that we're on. And that is, we search high and low for years. Like in Cara's case, almost a decade looking for Kara, and the perception of the individuals and those around them that know what they have done to an individual like Brittany or Kara, and they're sitting home having their beer, watching these distraught mothers cry on television, watching our organization constantly doing media and posting flyers all over the place, and yet they sit there without any empathy, without any guilt, and know what they know and do nothing. That in itself is a crime, and that's why there should be more attorneys like you, Jared, because when I told you on the intro that I wished I had been an attorney, because all of our cases need to lawyer up to hold people accountable for the things that they should have done. And we keep getting reminded it's not against the law not to tell somebody about a crime. But I think that should be changed.
Well, I think the level of narcissism, and it's obviously Dr. Mathis is the person to talk about the narcissism of criminals. When I say Moody was getting anxious when he saw that, it certainly wasn't regret or remorse. It was probably concern for his own freedom and ultimately that he was going to be caught.
Exactly.
But you cannot – one thing I learned in this business, the business of prosecution and politics and government and being on this side of crime, you cannot apply logic to an illogical situation. So it is illogical that another human being would treat another human being in the horrific and violent way that Moody conducted himself with Brittany. So you can't apply logic to that. However,
that is true.
You know, and that we keep seeing it. So trying to think about the way you would react, Michelle, and putting that upon the Raymond Moody's of the world really – will only give you a headache. It's just going to be the frustration level. It's
you know
just not
me
gonna,
so
it's like
well.
Bang.
And we've only known each other an hour.
See that? My formal training is in, I always tell it, but I could tell, you know, but I appreciate that frustration. In all these years, you know, you see it in so many manifestations. We really do. That human beings are capable of so many good things, but as Dr. Mathis said, and as Michelle, you may have said it, there are people that are ill-intended. There is evil in this world. There are bad guys and there are bad gals in this world. And, you know, we can't be naive and not recognize that they exist, or you will be a rabbit in the forest with no protection. You know, you cannot be naive and assume that everybody out there is well-intended, because they aren't, sadly.
That is
exactly
true.
And
I just want to remind
go ahead, Michelle.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dr. Mathis. Gotta love technology. Just a reminder, if you're listening to the show and have any questions for any of our guests, the call-in number is 515-602-9601. And I also want to reiterate, today is the 40th anniversary of the National Missing Children's Awareness Day. And you, too, can look at posters at the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and find your area where you live and go to missingkids.org and enter the information, and you can see some of the faces and cases missing from around your area. It doesn't take but 2 seconds to look it up and share it on social media. It can make all the difference in the world. And I also want to throw out that our show Spotlight for Justice is made possible by a grant from the Jason Hauser Foundation, and we can't say enough about him and his foundation for supporting us throughout the years for our Missing Children's Division. Kathy, Dr. Mathis, what were you going to say?
Well, I was just going to follow up with what Jared had said about Dawn and surrounding herself, because that is a very important component of resilience and being able to manage through this process, is that you surround yourself with people who want to be a part of, who can support you in different areas, and bring in different people with different strengths to be your team member, you know, to have a mental health person to help you through the roller coaster of emotions, to have somebody like Jared be a part of that can, you know, help with that legal process, and to have media, you know, somebody that's good with the media, because all of these different areas, and I mean, I can go on and on with people that we, you know, can look at to bring into these lives, but to find those individuals who are dedicated and committed to helping you because they care about you is really mm-hmm. important. And right. and to be able to, when you are falling apart, at least be there to listen. And I think Jared mentioned something about this, that when, you know, he was asked to be a part of this case, he was asked to just listen to her. And sometimes that's the most important thing that we can offer somebody, because, you know, we all have our issues, you know, Whitty also said some people, you know, embraced her when she came to South Carolina, and others said we didn't, you know, they didn't want her around. Well, that's typical. That's typical not only in society, but it's typical within our circle of friends and family. And for whatever reason, we have this idea of, well, you should just get over it and move on. You know, and so they start to begin to put time limits on grief and loss. They put their perspective of, you know, how somebody should feel and what somebody should do, and yet they don't have an idea or a clue what it's like to go through this process. And this is a process that does not go away. It is with right. these family members for the rest of their lives, and everybody else, instead of putting their biases and their judgment and sitting back and having their beer, watching somebody on, get up and be a part of something that makes a difference, not only for the family, but for our community and for our country. Because if we all don't have a part in making things different and being supportive, what happens when it happens to you? You know, we all think, oh, this mm-hmm. is not going to happen to me. And yet yeah. it does. And you hear people all the time say, I didn't expect this to happen to me.
Yeah.
So finding those people and putting your teams together is really important in sustaining the family members of these missing and murdered children.
You know, Dr. Mathis, it does happen to all of us. We may not have a missing child. We may not go through the kind of trauma that these families have had to go through over the years, but it's all of our problem. And I'm not going to get political. You and Dawn know I can be, but the bottom line is this impacts all of our pocketbooks. Every time you go to work and you pay a tax, your tax dollars are supposed to be there for when you go file a police report. Your tax dollars are there for them to do their job to find your missing loved one. No family should have to go through the kind of expenses and endure what they have to endure, especially after decade long. Look at Star Laura, whose sister Jamie has been missing since 1971. You know, cases like that can go on and on and on. And what family, what the public don't realize is, yeah, it's impacting the families, but these are cases that many of times could be easily solved or solved a lot quicker than they are. And
right. Michelle, you raise
dedicated
a very important
FBI agents to come to
well,
the table.
Michelle, you raise a very important point, too.
Yeah.
Raymond Moody, so Raymond Moody, as we said, is the defendant and has acknowledged his role in killing Brittany, kidnapping her, and burying her. All of the evidence that essentially convicted Moody was in the hands of law enforcement for just about the entire time this investigation was going on. He was named very early on as a suspect in Brittany's case. Much of what happens in these cases, and I've been a part of several cold cases, is a reexamination of the evidence that was before law enforcement from the beginning. Now, technological advances and DNA and all those things are great and may have helped solve a lot of cases, but the reality is there are many cases where motivated prosecutors, motivated investigators, and in Dawn's case, motivated volunteers like Kim, Jill, and everybody that's been with her and Steph, taking a fresh look at what has been investigated and what has been in the hands of the prosecutors since day one, you can find the answers you're looking for. You could put it all together, which leads to the discovery of re-interviewing certain people and confronting certain people with evidence. I've seen cold cases with information that has been held by investigators from day one. And that's unfortunate because the answers were right there in front of us all the while. And that's not to say they were wrong or they didn't see it. Oftentimes, people get fatigued. They go on to the next case. There aren't enough resources. You know, and again, some people just aren't very good at their jobs. That's the other thing. Their training is poor. They don't have the level of passion required to do this kind of work.
Well, they have much of an ego, too.
Well, that's part of it, too. I think people don't understand. I call it the politics of prosecution. They don't understand the competitive nature oftentimes, interdepartment competitive nature. Also, too, when an investigation gets robust and you have several departments working the same case, take the JonBenet Ramsey case, for example, or how many other cases where you have multiple jurisdictions doing an investigation. Oftentimes, one hand doesn't know what the other is doing. They don't necessarily share information properly.
Just like Brittany's case.
And when that happens, when the right hand doesn't know what the left is doing and they don't share information, you can have the answers in the file and not know it. I've seen it.
And it's sad because here we are where Brittany's remains have been found. Not all families can ever have that kind of closure. You've laid your baby to rest. But now then you went through the murder, the trial, but now you're still seeking answers for where we failed. And it's just a roller coaster, Dr. Mathis, that we never get off of.
Right. I want to add thing to what Jared said because it's really important and I don't want to pass by without people thinking about this and my asking the question. So Jared, based on what you said, that a lot of times there are different people working on these cases and one hand doesn't know what the other one is doing. So a simple system of putting everyone connected to a case on the same computer with the same information, a database, you know, whatever you want to call it. But people working on a case where everybody knows what the other one is doing, whether they're in the same state or not, would be something that we should be looking at so that we can't say in the future one hand doesn't know what the other hand is doing because everybody working on a case are all connected with a central, you know, point to see what is going on with that case. Is that not something that can happen?
I'm going to tell you, it absolutely is. I was involved with a case that involved probably 800 interviews, 30,000 pages of materials, and the entire file was scanned into a database and a laptop that became searchable. And I can't tell you. So all the pieces of the puzzle were there, right? But they were in different boxes.
Yeah.
Okay, so when everything comes together and you have all the pieces and you have the corners and the sides and you start to put the picture together, only then can you make your case. And I'm going to tell you, as simple as building that database on – it was a case of Hugo Selinsky, which was a case in northeastern Pennsylvania. That is when some of the questions we had were answered several years before we found with interviews within other departments. And – technology, like you said, as simple as sharing of information on one database would be huge. And it's a big help, huge help.
And there are those databases out there. So why aren't we? Why isn't law enforcement doing that?
Well, some of them are. I don't know that certainly not all of them, but they should be encouraged to do so. You know, it's one thing you build a task force and it looks good, and we'll say we have four or five departments working this case. The question that needs to be asked is how are they working together? Okay, we have a program through the federal government now, and for the past several years, where local detectives, municipal detectives, or county detectives rendezvous with the FBI, where they're assigned physically to the FBI local offices. That has so you have street cops working with federal agents. That program has yielded tremendous success because you have individuals who know their neighborhoods. They know the little old lady who sits on her front porch, who's got a lot of information from that street. They know the confidential informant. They convey that information because they're working arm-in-arm with federal agents every day. That meshing of the two departments together has yielded tremendous results. The problem is it's one of resources, sadly. It's one of ignorance and pride sometimes. You know, you could have a sheriff in a town that says, I don't need these fancy FBI guys coming down here and telling me my business, right? Certainly you have some of that. But people need to put their pride aside, sadly, in these cases, and that's what needs to happen.
You really do. So we've lost Dawn again. So Jared, tell us where you and Dawn go from here, and how can our listeners help with the next phase of justice for Brittany?
Well, how people can help is just don't let Brittany's story die. Let it keep it out there and be inspired by the strength of this woman. I mean, I'm inspired by it. I was afraid to say no to Dawn. Hell, okay, there's only one answer. You could tell somebody this. But certainly keep her story alive. It's not over. The investigation continues. I mean, I really can't get too deep into that other than to say we're not done. We are pursuing a civil claim against Raymond Moody, which isn't fairly typical in these type of cases, and we are looking to do our own investigation to get some answers that we don't feel like we've gotten so far. Where that will lead, who knows? That is the drudgery and length of that process. It certainly isn't a quick process, but Dawn Drexel is not going away.
Going away, Jared, and there is no excuse whatsoever that they can give me. I'll tell you that right now. I just want people to realize, like, you know, these families, and especially me, you know, I've went through years and years of PTSD, anxiety, you know, going to counseling and things like that. I have a huge support group, yes, but I've had a lot of loss, too. I lost both of my brothers, and after they found Brittany, my dad had and he passed away in September. So I've tried strong and everybody's, but you know, it's so much loss, like just in my immediate family. Thank God I still have my mom. But I'll tell you, I the only consolation I have with my dad is that he's up there taking care of Brittany until I get there. You know, because my parents are my heart, and you know, so is Brittany, and you know, people, you know, I think these law enforcement agencies, they need to really listen to these families, you know, and just like, just do your job, like. I don't know what else to say because I am so frustrated about Brittany's and how it was handled.
And let's also, so that our listeners understand, like with any industry, there's always going to be your good seeds and your bad seeds. And your lazy people and your overworkers, you know, and police departments are no different. This isn't a reflection on policing. It's a reflection on holding accountable those that are too lazy to get the job done. If they're not doing their job, don't make excuses for them. Replace them. And so that somebody can come in and get the job done and why they're there. Dr. Mathis, I want to talk just a few minutes. We have a few minutes left about what about the other kids in the families, the siblings that are left watching distraught parents have to parent them, but the parents are lost. What's that do on the children left in the home?
It's a very good question because they also suffer unmeasurable devastation as well. They're affected by the unresolved loss that happens in their family as well. And a lot of times they feel that they are not as important as the child that, you know, went missing or was murdered because everybody's focusing on that child and mm-hmm. they are like the forgotten yep. child or children in that, you know, in that family system. And so we need to remember that they need to have help as well. They need to have the parents not only, you know, focus on the missing child or the murdered child, but also to refocus and know that the children that are living and part of the family need support, they need love, they need attention, and they also want to be a part of finding some closure for themselves. And so mm-hmm. how is that going to happen? So the families, this is where I think the team approach, you know, to surround yourself with, which Dawn has done, is so important because you can have individuals as part of that team that are also helping the children who, you know, are outside of the focus of, you know, attention of media and everybody else to help them with their emotional roller coasters with their, you know, where do I stand? How do I deal with this? You know, their fears, their anxiety, their trauma reactions, et cetera. So unfortunately, a lot of times they get left out and
yep.
the consequences are devastating and can be yep. Something that affects them for their lifetime.
Yeah, Dr. Mathis, you're exactly right because I know that with my kids were very young, disappeared. Marissa was only 11 and Camden, he was 5. But Marissa, you know, feels like I abandoned her because I was so consumed with Brittany's case. And I wish I could go back and change. Unfortunately, I can't. But I know it affected her. You know, I feel horrible about it because I love all my children to death, you know. But, you know, I can't go back and she didn't feel that. But you understand where she was coming from. It was just and was with them, and I wasn't there for her.
Yeah. And that is very normal, you know, for a child to have that reaction. And again, stress affects everybody differently. The pressure of having a sibling who was murdered, you know, become the focus. I will self-disclose here for a minute that I had a younger brother who passed away when I was 5. And I remember being a sibling where everybody's focus was on his death and the loss
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. my going, wow, everybody's focused on him and not me, and how that affected me. I had many conversations with my mother and my father afterwards, trying to find within myself as a little girl growing up some resolution. I'm going to call it resolution for myself. And I sat down and I talked with them about how I felt, you know, watching them. And it was something that my mother never got over, and neither did my dad until the day they died. And mm-hmm. so having that been in my family, and understanding child who was trying to figure out how I can be okay with that happening as well, took not only, you know, counseling, but also healing with my mom and my dad. And that's very
I like how you used resolution. I like that word. You know, you always hear of everybody saying, you know, you got closure. I don't think you can ever get closure of losing a child. I think that it's a resolution. You have the resolution of what happened.
Yes. And have an empathy and understanding between us that I may not walk in my parents' shoes, but they listened to me, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, they said they were sorry, you know, the apologies and the you can't go back and change. You know, one of the definitions of forgiveness is giving up all hope for a better past. And mm-hmm. I love that definition, and I use it a lot with my survivors, because it doesn't mean what happened is okay. It doesn't mean turning the other cheek. It doesn't mean anything except you find some resolution in giving up the hope that you thought things were going to happen a certain way and it didn't. And so you have to, you know, within yourself and within your family system, come to those resolutions, because this is something that doesn't ever go away.
Right.
We have a few more minutes. Dawn and Jared, any last thoughts or anything you would like to share, any events coming up, anything that our listeners can help you with?
Don, go ahead.
The only thing I can express that we can, you know, the other person that is involved in Brittany's case and get our justice through that. And, you know, I'm always praying for the missing and their families, and my heart goes out to them. You know, I know what you're going through. If anybody ever needs to talk or whatnot, I'm here. You know, I got very involved in the missing persons world. I have a lot of resources, and, you know, we're just at the end of Brittany's case, you know, I just want the accountability. Accountability is huge to me. I just want the person that was involved be held accountable, because then my daughter can rest in peace. Jared, I don't know if you want to answer or say anything else.
Only to say that hopefully Brittany's and Don's story serves as an inspiration to people that are still waiting for answers, and we're going to continue our work together. You know, we certainly have encountered some folks along the way that have reached out on social media looking for their own justice, and all over the country, really, and something, a turn in my life I didn't fully expect, but you know, we're going to try to help as many people as we can, you know, and each case mm-hmm. is special and unique. And presents its own set of challenges, but don't stop. You know, one of the things I said to Don when we were on the ground in South Carolina was, we're only here because you never gave up. And we're talking with both of you tonight because Don never gave up.
Yeah. And we're also talking with you tonight because you listened to what Steph told you, and that was just to listen to Don. And
well, listen, in defense of Steph, he's gotten me in more trouble than.
I blew up Steph's phone quite a bit, Michelle. He's a very good friend of mine, and I'll tell you, you know, he always took my phone calls too. And if I need to talk to somebody or I want to get a hold of somebody to help me, I will. You know, and that was just, you know, they were always there. And, you know, the support that I have been given was tremendous, you know, and I love them. They're part of my family, and I could never repay them for the stuff that they've done for me.
He definitely is a good guy. And we thank you for being on the show this evening. And we're always here. Do you all have still Brittany's Facebook or a website or anything you'd like to throw out there?
Michelle, I might be able to give that to you at some point. I know the Myrtle Beach Police Department, they were working on something for Brittany's tree. It's
okay.
going to be scannable, which tells her story and all kinds of stuff. They're working on it right now, but I can get back to you on that.
Okay.
Yeah,
and we'll be
and
happy
then,
to
know,
post that for you.
All right. Yeah, that sounds great. And thank
right,
you so
well,
much. I'm sorry I dropped so many times.
No worries. Technology.
Thank you, Dr. Mathis. Thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you both. It's a pleasure to be with everybody.
I want to thank you both as well. I love meeting amazing people and being able to talk with amazing people and introduce you to everybody. So thank you both so much for spending time with Michelle and I today.
Our pleasure.
No, thank you.
You're welcome.
So, Dr. Mathis, as we close out this show, I know we have a lot going on in June. Any last thoughts as far as giving some helpful tips out there for other families going through the same hell that Dawn and her family were faced with?
Well, I think that, you know, we've just heard about some of the things that really helped Dawn, and also that the National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation is a resource as well, and to do not hesitate to reach out and to contact Michelle or any of the other, you know, on the website there's a way to contact and tell your story, and you know, we'll find somebody to listen to you. We'll help as much as we can in whatever is going on. And if we can't help, we certainly, and I say this because I know Michelle, I've known her for a long time, and she's tireless in the work that she does. But the rest of us who support and work with NWCAVE as well, we will do whatever we can. If we don't have the ability to help, we will find somebody who can. And I think that's really important in ending up our show, is to let people know, families out there know, that they are not alone, that there are wonderful prosecutors like Jared. There are wonderful friends and other people they might not even know that hear their story, that want to be a part of supporting them and letting them know that they're not alone, and to reach out. And don't isolate yourself. Don't think that whatever happened, you know, because guilt is also part of some of the emotional reactions that happen. You step outside of all of the emotions and reach out and get the help and support to be able to help yourself and your family through this process.
Definitely, definitely. And I want to end also by saying, you know, NWCAVE and our Missing Children's Division has been around a long time. We have worked on over 100 cases. I'm very, very proud of the work that we have done and the families that we have supported along the way. Media matters. That is the bottom line. So many times on so many of our cases, whether it was a kidnapping, a human trafficking case, you know, so many times media mattered because we got on the case and we exposed the case. We kept the face and case visible. We prefer to work with law enforcement agencies, but we are the buffer between law enforcement and the family. We're the ones that will be there 24 hours a day for the family, make sure that we print up flyers, we pay for them. And again, I have to say thank you to the Jason Hauser Foundation. He is a businessman in Clark County, Washington, who has been the sole supporter of our Missing Children's Division for the last 4 or 5 years. And without his monetary support, shows like this wouldn't be possible, but the cases wouldn't be possible either. I would think over the course of the last decade, of all the cases we've been on, I would have to say no more than 5 cases have ever contracted, retained us, and paid us for our services. All the other cases have been pro bono, and so many hours go into working with the families. And we are very proud of what we do for families of missing children. And over the years, we've done not only children, but also adults. And ultimately, adults are children of someone too. And so we have a track record where our goal is to bring a child, a loved one home one way or another. We would love to rescue them, but sometimes it's recovery, but we're still there. And so learn more about us at nwcave.org. We're also on Facebook, all of our social media, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook is all at NWCave. And then our next show is going to be on Wednesday, June 7th, with author Joseph Tooney, a client of ours. It's going to be a father's unimaginable loss. He's an author. His daughter, Brittany, was murdered in 2020 in Clark County, Washington. And we're going to discuss all that this father and grandfather has gone through in order to get justice for his Brittany. So that's our next show coming up on June 7th. Visit facebook.com/spotlightforjustice for all of our programming. And again, today is National Missing Children's Awareness Day, the 40th anniversary. Visit missingkids.org to learn more about how you can get involved and what you can do in your community. And again, Dr. Mathis, it's always a pleasure, and I know that I'm going to see you in a couple weeks. We have a lot in store as far as our survivor retreat and our grand opening of our headquarters and all that good stuff. So until we meet again, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Michelle. And I just want to piggyback that, you know, there are people out there that don't know what to do but would like to do something. And I want to reiterate, we don't always ask people to financially support NWCave. And I would love to reiterate that if you want to do something and you don't know what to do, you can certainly support the National Women's Coalition Against Violence and Exploitation financially for our Missing Children's Division and our Training and Education Division and our Survivor Division. And, I mean, there's all kinds of good things that your money will be used for. And I just want to encourage everybody to, you can make a difference. So
thank you,
please,
Dr.
help
Mathis.
Us out. You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. And until we meet again on June 7th, just remember, everyone has the power to make a difference. Thank you so much for joining us. This is Spotlight for Justice, and I'm Michelle Bart. Good night.